So the other thing I wanted to do is just recap a couple of the highlights that I could dig up from the literature from the first 2 days of the week, which was the electrical properties meeting. So the first one is actually something we show with our program quite a bit, and it's come up already today. And this is using, so this is from Raul Kopelman's lab at Michigan, and he's developed kind of a 30 nanometer particle that within it has one of these voltage measuring dyes. And that way he's able to measure the local voltage at any position within the cell. So it's not just within a membrane. And so first of all, he notices that none of this goes into the nucleus because his particles are too big. But then he sees this, if you take the green bar and you map it out, he's actually standardized what the intensity means as far as the standing voltage, or electric field, I guess, not just volts, because volts per meter. And he sees, you know, this large spike in the voltage, or the electric field, which he actually, with doing a number of colocalization measurements, thinks this is a mitochondria that's causing this spike in the electric field at that particular area of the cell. So I think, you know, a combination of his dyes and your dyes and the one I'll show next could help gain more understanding of these dynamic electrical properties within the cell. Yeah.
Last question. So what happens if you apply an external field
to this?
Can
well,
you then make the mitochondria move in the direction or whatever?
Yeah, I don't know. He did say that when he punctured the cell, that he lost all of the intensity.
So the field strength, if you crank it up the cell, of course, is electroporated. Is that what's happening in the cell?
I don't know.
Tolerate
it? I can tolerate it pretty
fine. If you try imposing external fields on these things, it's because it's salty water. You don't get it.
Well, you could do it by putting the whole thing in salt water.
Right. But if you just put a field on the cell,
guess what? There's no external electrical field in that experiment.
Yeah.
The lab in which the experiment was done.
It's a tough call to decide how much you want to say external electric fields can pass through a membrane that has a huge electric potential. I mean, all the models.
You can depolarize muscle cells in vivo.
Sure.
So you have two platinum electrodes.
Right.
You put a certain voltage.
They're stuck in an electrode.
Then it depolarizes.
Stuck in an electrode.
Stuck in just in the medium, just
right. You don't have the electrodes outside the petri dish, where you may
be able to
create a huge field, but the medium, of course, will screen it
within the water solution.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
So, Raul or Dr. Kopelman has since worked with Dr. Gatenby and Jessica through Moffitt to model how proteins within the cytoplasm may be diffusing because of these electric fields that are within the cell. So this brings up an interesting point, or it's addressing one of the points that I brought up, is how does a protein know where to go or where to localize within the cell? And because of the crowding and the slow diffusion rates, if you just let particles or these proteins freely diffuse through the cell, nothing would happen in a timely manner. And so this was one hypothesis of perhaps how these proteins are localized to various areas through, one, the electric fields, and then also a diffusion of pH throughout the cell. So that a protein migrates or diffuses to its isoelectric point within the cell, and then also, Jessica can correct me, and then also to the area within the electric field that makes it neutral, essentially, right?
It's doing its own isoelectric
function. Yes.
So you have a pH gradient then? And you have it in the cell?
Yeah, but it doesn't. So there is a pH gradient, and it's, depending on which cell you measure, it's only 0.2 or 0.4.
Okay, it's small.
Yeah. But what's interesting about a lot of the isoelectric points of these particles that are in these pathways is that very rarely do you find one that has an isoelectric point within normal physiological. They're very low or very high, and what that would do in if the cell was just all 7.0 or whatever. If you have a low isoelectric point, it actually wants to pull towards the nucleus, and a high isoelectric point will push it away, which is interesting.
Have you done the same thing for RNA? Mm-hmm.
Just protein pathways so far.
Mm-hmm. So our discussions on Monday, Tuesday, and Stuart can help me out here, was that if we had this proposed electric field within a cell, it basically couldn't be maintained. One, because you'd have to have a really strong current, and which was kind of physiologically not relevant or not feasible. And then also there would be a massive amount of heat generation due to maintaining this electric field or the current. That would basically kill the cells immediately. So then it was brought up, well, maybe there are just these local electric gradients that are still doing the same thing, but maybe not in the specific way that Jessica has modeled linearly across the cell. And then there was the idea that was brought up that somehow these proteins are osmotically moving with charge along the microtubules, or perhaps electroosmotic, yeah, that's the term. And now that we've seen that the mitochondria move all around the cell like that, you know, it makes your mind think, I guess, the thing.
So this is as opposed to active transport?
Yeah, so there are proteins that are actively transported, but it's usually after they're translated, then they're actively transported to the nuclear membrane.
So about half the proteins that target mitochondria are actually mRNAs targeted to mitochondria.
Really?
And there's local translation, co-translational exhortation.
Oh.
And the other half are made in the regular way.
Right.
And then find the mitochondria. Nobody knows how fast or and so forth.
So I think the point that he's emphasizing here, because for folks who weren't at the first workshop, is Bob's very nice hypothesis is that the act of phosphorylation results in electric transport in an electric field, which is a very nice idea.
Right.
Yes. For some reason, perhaps Raoul's measurements of local electric field, a gradient was chosen, a voltage gradient, which was just observed to maintain in the cytoplasm. But that said, it is a very nice idea. One way of getting, if you like, active transport for a phosphorylated protein that's different from that from a neutral protein is to have at some point in the process an electric field that results in selective transport of proteins with a larger charge.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to try to transport from the membrane to the nucleus, but I wonder if there's a secondary story about transporting into the mitochondria.
Right.
Same principle.
Why were you talking about RNAs being targeted?
So the thing's called late caps. Well, because this was discovered, these are called zip code sequences in the 3' UTR. So there were RNA, there was local protein translation at the site of use, as opposed to an inefficient quote, you make the RNA, you make the protein, now you've got to travel 50 miles to deliver it to a synapse or something.
Are you talking about normal ribosomes or
normal ribosomes? Yeah, yeah.
I thought you were talking about microribosomes.
Mm-hmm. No. Normal ribosomes. And for mitochondria, these 1,500 proteins, about half do it that way and the other half don't. And it seems to be whether or not those proteins were of prokaryotic origin as opposed to the new guys.
Hmm.
So the new guys prefer to transport the
truth be told, I don't remember around which is which.
Right.
I just have a simple question. Is there any evidence of any material transported to the mitochondria from the cell membrane, not from the plasma membrane? I know retrograde transport was PR and Golgi, but the mitochondria, is there any important to the mitochondria on the outside?
Any what?
Any
important
to
the
mitochondria?
Well, any proving that is...
There's evidence that the mitochondria are transported. Cell to cell.
Right.
How weird is that?
Yeah.
Mitochondria. But
we were
talking about the mitochondria as this oxygen sensor or as a energy sensor within the cell yesterday. And so if I think about that, then obviously things have to have accessibility very quickly to the mitochondria, whatever that protein is. I don't know if that would be diffusing from the cell membrane itself. To the mitochondria.
Are we talking about proteins or signaling molecules. That's something different, I think.
No, one and the same.
No, but they behave completely different.
Yeah, any cargo. I mean, the one that I can only think of is doing immunological synapse with, I guess, granzymes are released, and then they go to mitochondria to depolarize them in order to induce apoptosis there. But just constitutively, import of material from outside, is any of it destined to mitochondria?
To the mitochondria direct.
I mean,
yeah.
I know this. I guess this transfer from nucleus to the mitochondria. We all.
Or even of any of these signaling.
Yeah.
Molecules.
But I think the diffusional properties really depend on the size.
No,
if you have a small molecule, you don't need any transport.
Right, but
right.
If
it will be at an instant everywhere.
If there were active transport, like in the case of retrograde transport, you could still. I mean, what I'm saying is the zip code is there anything that takes it to the mitochondria instead of Golgi or ER? That
the mRNA?
No.
External
protein. You're talking about plasma membrane.
Yes.
Not external
to the cell. Either something that's in endocytosis or constitutive.
Not that I know of,
yeah.
But the reverse is true. There are any number of mitochondrial proteins that are sticking to the plasma membrane, especially in endothelium.
Okay, so the second story, the second story that kind of came out was the dynamics of membrane potential, and this would be the cell membrane, in mammalian cells during embryogenesis, which was shown by Michael Levine, and I tried to get some of his movies, but couldn't find any. And so he basically showed that as a Drosophila or a Xenopus is developing, that you see these changes in the membrane potential by using one of these voltage dyes.
This is plasma membrane potential.
Okay.
Yeah, not
Yeah, plasma membrane potential.
Okay.
And it's specific to the type of organ that it's turning into, and also has a time lapse or a time scale associated with it. So the other presenter presented this novel fluorescent molecule that can be taken to a membrane protein, which allows you to monitor like very, very quickly.
Well, that's the rhodopsin.
Yes,
paper.
It's the rhodopsin
nice
paper. And so he showed that you can measure an on or an off just based on a quick change in a pH at the membrane, and this particular fluorophore is pH sensitive. And so pH sensitive in that it changes with intensity very drastically. And so, let's see.
Picked up the movie from his paper because we were all in awe over it, and after watching the mitochondria stuff. So these are just E. coli at room temperature and pH 8, and they blink. So they're constantly changing their membrane potential on and off. And so after seeing the mitochondria, it was like, wow.
There's a newer one in 2012. They used the mammalian neurons.
And they see,
they see it.
Yeah, he showed it with the neurons too. Yeah.
So they removed the proton sensitivity, and now you have just a light dependent membrane potential sensor without any proton after.
Yeah, and Eric, going back to your question about actually determining time, you could try to see the progression of it. They've been able to do that now, where what they call super resolution time lapse imaging. So they can get it down to kind of the, I forget how quick the time scale was, but it was very narrow, and they were actually able to see the wave propagate through the neurons. So
yeah, you talk about time resolution.
Yes, time resolution.
So they
time
have an electrical recording and an optical recording, and they are exactly on top of each other.
Yeah.
So instead of an electrical measurement, you could use the optical ones. It's
yeah.
Exactly the same dynamics.
Yeah.
So in a way they're breathing together, are they?
Well, so that's the thing. It's not correlated at all with these E. coli. It was completely random. They actually think it's a way for the E. coli to purge protons from their intracellular body.
So E-plus, so ions.
Yeah.
E-plus? Yeah. E-plus. Material was vomiting out the extra,
and
it was calcium. In order, yeah, it was calcium.
Yeah,
in order to reset the membrane potential.
same drop, and the same thing is happening in these mitochondria, right? So you depolarize these mitochondrial membranes, and somebody said something about calcium today.
But I think it was the opposite thing, like they do that in order to drop them.
Yeah. And these guys are doing it to reset.
Reset. Yeah, because,
So both of these workshops have left me asking questions from my perspective, which is a chemical engineer. So for me, obviously, this membrane potential, whether it's the mitochondria membrane potential or the plasma membrane, is making an impact that I don't think we fully understand quite yet what it's doing. I think with mitochondria, we understand that it's affecting the diffusion through these pores. But does the same thing, but how does that affect everything surrounding it in the cell, I guess, is a good question. Specifically, perhaps relating to the protein diffusion and localization that Jessica's working on. So is there some way that she can now incorporate these very dynamic mitochondria with various charges into her model? We don't know. The other thing is, you know, when we're talking about mitochondria as a sensor of the energy in the cell, I'm very curious as to how it's doing that. And so I don't know if the biology or the mechanism has worked out for that, but.
Yeah, well, there's something on it's AMPK, which is outside the mitochondria.
Okay, but so that allows it to sense it needs more energy or it needs less energy.
ADP-ATP ratio. That is whether AMP is kinase or not, and then there's a whole bunch of other things that go after that. And so that's believed to be the main energy sensor of the cell.
Cool. And it acts quite quickly, I'm told.
Right.
Seconds.
Okay. So then the question is the energy load in cancer cells higher or lower compared to the quote unquote normal cell? We would assume yes, but do we know? And defining self-fitness or advantage, I thought that was a very interesting discussion that came up, because usually you think of fitness as a proliferation fitness advantage, but it might not be proliferation. And I think, as Roger alluded to, we see cancer cells don't divide sometimes. Or why do you have a dormant cancer cell?
But also, the point is, it's not just the replication rate, but it's the replication versus death rate.
Yes.
So even if they're ticking over, replicating slowly, if they just don't die, then they're not killing
it. Right. So, but how do we incorporate that? And then, what gives it that advantage? So why do they know to change their system in a self-sacrificing way that a normal cell doesn't? So I guess what is that?
That's where you earlier remarked about we need a full. Thermodynamic analysis of the
and then coming back to the evolution stuff is stress the trigger. So I know these are broad philosophical questions.
Nature's floors of action. Do people ever think about it as something in the surrounding normal cells that is allowing a cell in the center to start replicating outwards? As opposed to this guy pushing this.
No,
guy.
No.
Does anyone think about
let me pull up
cells around here that are sort of receding?
No, so let me show you
whatever.
This video. So there's actually evidence that normal cells in a way promote migration of these other cells. So they just push them out of the way. They say, you're not normal. I don't want to be next to you. And they sense that through various cadherin receptors or the modulus of that cell. They know that you're harder or softer than what I'm used to being next to. So I'm going to keep pushing you along. And so on a single cell, like if you put a single cell into a group of normal cells, the normal cells will push the cancer cells.
Just squeeze them out?
Yes, essentially.
I thought we heard earlier this week, I would add to your list of aberrant properties your membrane potential as well.
Right, so actually, I can show you this video.
Maybe mitochondrial, but who knows? Obvious.
So another reason to add granocyte into cells.
I might have to find it.
I'm disappointed you didn't show the two-headed planaria.
I only...
Four-headed.
Four-headed, yeah, that's my favorite.
I like the two
billboard and
the two tail ones.
Yes.
The
what's a two head
So instead of making a tail, it made a head? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, they actually had a four-headed one. And do they develop normally? The answer is, well, they take a bit long because the heads need to learn to coordinate with one another. And a zero-headed gonorrhea worked okay.
Yes.
It used other bits of its neural system.
That's a lesson to all of us.
Yes.
Okay, so this is a nature blog, and this clump right here is kind of, is a normal set of cells. This is what it essentially looks like. So I forget which is which. The green cells would be the cancer cells, the red cells would be the normal cells. So this is actually, if you put half and half into a ball, they segregate out. So if you have them well mixed and you put them into a gel, they separate out into normal versus cancerous. But yet you see that the cancer cells are getting pushed out of the spheroid. And it's actually a video.
That's a movie. Ah.
The video is not in color. So you see, they come from the core center, the green center, and they get pushed along out of the spheroid.
Can you really tell if it's tough to imagine that you know that it's them pushing or it pulling? Can you actually tell the difference?
So with this data, it's hard to tell. She's monitoring cells pulling.
Okay.
Because
I feel like they look.
There's other evidence when you do kind of a single cell. It looks like it's.
Is this cell motility or reproduction?
Motility.
Yes,
well,
so cells are moving.
Yes.
Okay.
So
no.
What do they think?
They don't know. I mean, it's just a matter that the cell recognizes that the one next to it, and it immediately wants to find ones that are very similar.
So, I mean, like the two cells contact each other,
yeah.
You have something called an adherence junction.
Yes.
So there's cadherin.
Yes.
And those, is that what they think?
So, yes, each cell or each type of cell has its own cadherin fingerprint, so type of cadherins, and each of those have different affinities to one another. So it can tell immediately based on that, and there's some evidence to show that it becomes kind of a surface tension thing. So they act like immiscible fluids. So because it sees that cell doesn't match up the same.
So.
But then there's also evidence that it pulls on that cell and can tell immediately what the modulus of that cell is.
So, you know, we talked about Alzheimer's the other day, and why did we not get cancer? So the gamma secretase complex, which is disturbed in that protein, operates also at a low level on adherence junctions.
Mm-hmm.
In adherence junctions.
Yeah.
So maybe, in fact, the failure to have gamma secretase do this would be that the cell does not understand this, does not push it out, and it stays dormant.
Right.
Huh. How's that screwball?
No, it is screwball. So these are just some questions. There's many more, but it's kind of what I threw together this morning. So,
Well, I think, well, thank you, Nicole. We've added a bit.